there's a living wildness that's taking place. For me, what that is possibility. Possibility in this era when nearly everything seems impossible is a very, very precious thing.
This is the Ecology of Ideas podcast, the podcast about how the ecological crisis is foremost a crisis in our ways of thinking. I'm Otto Lematon. This episode is particularly special. Our guest is Nora Bateson, systems thinker, ecological philosopher, writer, filmmaker, and much, much more. And the reason why this is special is because the concept behind this podcast, to have conversations about how we need to learn to think ecologically rather than just to think about ecology, is directly inspired by Nora's work and her family legacy she's maintaining. Her father, Gregory Bateson, was a renowned anthropologist and ecological thinker. The phrase ecology of ideas we borrowed directly from him as the title of this podcast. And Nora's grandfather, William Bateson, was an evolutionary biologist who coined the term genetics. During our conversation, Nora will take us on a journey to understand why ecology is more than environmental awareness and how ecological thinking makes us see differently from the way we raise our kids to health, nature, global crises, and on, all part of an ecology of ideas. And now, let's welcome Nora to the podcast. Hi, Nora. Welcome to the Ecology of Ideas podcast. You're calling in from Sweden, if that's correct.
Yeah, hello.
I hope you had a fantastic day.
I have had a day, a good day, a fantastic day, even. Nice to be here.
Just to start the conversation, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
It's always an interesting thing because in order to try to create an introduction, what one has to do is edit, right? And so Immediately I'm picking things to say or not say, to share or not share. And generally speaking, in this type of circumstance, what one is supposed to do, according to the codes of our culture, is to essentially just list a series of professional accomplishments, job titles, maybe some degrees, publications, things like that.
That's right, yeah.
But of course, that's not really who I am. I have degrees and publications and professional achievements. But I guess if you were to ask me, who are you? The only thing I could really honestly say is I'm not sure yet.
Yeah.
Because part of that question has to do with who I am when I'm with you and who we bring out in each other. So, for me, that's very much an ecological question of who can I be when I'm with you? So you can read down my CV if you want, but that's not really going to say what will come out in our podcast about me or about you or about how we are in our world.
Right. And you know, that's actually the reason why I phrased the question the way I phrased it is, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, and you can choose what you choose to tell about yourself in terms of the audience and what we think they would love to hear, and that we are more than our CV. Hopefully we can establish in this conversation. I'm really much looking forward to. I am more than my CV as well. but you mentioned ecology, and it's an ecological question. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by ecology and how you got into these ecological issues and questions? We're going to talk a bit more about what you personally find fascinating about ecology.
Well, I think what I find fascinating about ecology, as well as frustrating, is that in an ecology, all of the organisms or ideas or entities that are in relationship are in changing relationship from multiple different directions. And these changes are ongoing and open-ended. They must be so. Otherwise, there's not an ecology.
Right.
So If you look at this in terms of a meadow, which is one of my favorite metaphors to use, what you see is that meadow has to keep meadowing. And in order for the meadow to meadow, all of the organisms that are part of that meadowing process have to be able to shift according to drought, according to seasons, according to the fluctuations of various populations of other organisms. So there's nothing static about it. So I think one of the things that has been so frustrating with the discussion of the ecological process is that there is such an existing grouping of ideas around how to define and explain what an ecology is. And those ideas are locked into various more industrial metaphors. So the next thing you know, you're talking about a meadow like a big Swiss watch. And it might be a little weirder, a little juicier, a little less predictable. But nevertheless, there is this underpinning idea that it is, and I'm going to use the word with some disdain here, functioning. And I would like to invite us to be very, very careful with ever using words like functioning when we're talking about living systems.
And in a sense, this notion of living systems and ecological thinking, just for our audience, is not necessarily tied to what we would call the environment or quote-unquote the natural world, whatever that may be. It's a broader term that sees connections not tied to the natural phenomena.
There's lots of different ways of defining the word ecology. One of them is that they're patterns of relationships that are interdependent. But I think you have to be careful with that definition, because remembering those patterns are changing. The interdependencies are also changing. But what isn't changing is that there is an ongoing communicative relational intershaping process. So even with ideas, you can have an ecology of ideas, like this podcast suggests, and those ideas are shaping each other, you know. And if one idea becomes dominant, then it's going to make it so that the other ones don't have a lot of space.
Right.
So if you think of some of the premises or the principles of permaculture, what you're looking at is not necessarily which plants are thriving, but how plants are in relationship to allow them to grow in different ways.
Right.
So, you know, again, with ideas or with family members or with meadows, you're looking at that same question of not what is the tree or what is the idea or who is the family member, but how are they in interdependent relational process that is changing? You know what it reminds me of is that scene in Through the Looking Glass where they're playing croquet. And Alice has been given a flamingo for her croquet mallet. And the actual ball is a hedgehog.
Right.
And then in this Through the Looking Glass world, there are these little soldiers that are the wickets. And all of the game pieces are alive. And so they have a mind of their own. They just do what they want to do, where they go where they want to go. And Alice is very frustrated because she can't get control of the game. But I think that metaphor is good. So, you know, she can try to make the flamingo head hit the hedgehog, but the flamingo might move and the hedgehog might move and they both could go running off in separate directions. And then again, the wickets could run off too.
Yeah, right.
So, but this business of there being these ongoing changing variables, in ecological system defies the habit of a kind of on the paper ossified definition process. And so this is why with my book, I called it combining and not combinations, right? So there's this need to, in all of our description of these ecological process, to remain hyper-vigilant, that our language does not allow for the ghosts of mechanistic understanding to sneak in.
You are continuing a family legacy also with your International Bateson Institute, which is situated in Sweden, I guess in Stockholm, if I'm correct. Yeah. You're continuing a family legacy going back to your grandfather, William Bateson, who came up with the term genetics and studied, was a quite influential biologist. And of course, then your father, Gregory Bateson, also an ecologist and anthropologist, and very much as an inspiration for this podcast. So as you said, the title of this podcast, The Ecology of Ideas, is in direct homage to your dad's work specifically. And of course, now the way you continue it. And I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that legacy and how you are giving it life with your own work. You're keeping it alive. You're not putting it in a museum, in a sense.
Yeah, well, I think one thing that has been very exciting is just I'm still learning from it. And there's a lot to learn from. I think a lot of people would say that my father's work can be really difficult to read.
One could say, yes, that's
one
true.
One could say. And they probably have never read any of William's work, which is even more difficult.
Okay.
And I have a lot of respect for that because both of them were very aware that language and communication invites existing ideas in. And so if you read carefully, you'll notice that there are ways in which things are phrased that are very, very careful not to, like I was saying before, invite those ghosts in. Mm-hmm. And I think this started with William, who was a bit of a warrior, actually. And he was fighting to protect the integrity of the study that he named genetics. Mm-hmm. And he was doing this during the time when eugenics was finding its bloom.
Right, yeah.
In the scientific world, and particularly rooted in the Cambridge and Oxfordshire scientific realm, but also globally. Right. I mean, the Swedes were in on it. The Americans were in on it. Yeah. It was sort of all over.
Yes.
But there was a very limited grouping of scientists who were working with these ideas. And that made it very difficult for William because a lot of the people who he was actually most frustrated with were his good friends. People he took summer vacations with, people who came to visit him, people whose children played with his children. And I think most recently I have felt the agony of what he must have been going through to see that there was this eagerness to bring genetics into eugenics.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't let that happen. Mm. He just kept saying, if you do the science, you will find out that you cannot control nature. You cannot make a predetermined outcome. You will make a disaster. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just eugenics in terms of breeding and reproductive rights that he was talking about. It was a whole, we should be very careful with this in general.
Right.
Francis Galton's doctrine on eugenics to begin with says quite clearly in black and white, he saw this as much more than a way to control mutation. It was actually what he wanted to be, and I quote, a religion.
Right.
That would permeate the whole culture, which it did. And the seeds of industrial thought were there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the real peak of industrial shift, which happened in the latter part of the 1700s into the mid 1800s, brought with it the logic of the factory. And I want to really bring that word logic in.
Yeah.
Because the logic of industry is not the same as the logic of ecology. So he did what he could, clearly, and obviously he failed. Mm. It was the early days. So, you know, in 1910, 1911, he was warning that someone was going to get a hold of this eugenics and there was going to be more violence than had ever been seen before based upon it. And he was right. But he couldn't convince his colleagues to stop trying to predetermine an outcome in a living system. Mm-hmm. And that's the big one. I believe we are actually still working on that problem.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, somehow got a new life with the idea of designer babies and genetic screening. This dream of controlling your offspring or your controlling living systems still very much alive today.
Well, I mean the IQ test, standardized testing.
Yes, there you go.
I mean every single one of the early statisticians mm-hmm. were eugenicists.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, whenever we're looking at a statistical marker, we're looking at information that can only be derived by decontextualizing, ossifying, and freezing a particular segment of an otherwise living, moving, shifting ecology.
Right. Yeah.
So the fact that we are premising so much of the strategy and the forward movement and even our understanding of knowledge based on information that is actually pulled out of its living process.
Mm-hmm. And if you take us through that legacy from your grandfather to your father and how you continue that journey that also your father then contributed.
My father was coming into a very different era.
Yes.
A very different culture. He actually left England and studied in New Guinea and Bali, and then went to the United States in the Second World War. And he became interested in information technology, in ecology, in other ways, in culture, mm-hmm. And in psychology as an ongoing study of ecology. Okay, so he is known for studying and actually has seminal thinking in lots of different disciplines. So you could actually look at his work and say, yeah, but he never really got a start. He just had a lot of false starts. What did he ever actually do? But in fact, what he was doing was he was working on the ground with a lot of different contextual bodies of language, jargon, mm-hmm. academic study, etc., but applying that through his understanding of living process. So he was also very frustrated and also lonely because he ran into very similar problems, which was that people were always wanting to take things apart and never wanting to put them back together again. And the putting them back together again requires a kind of rigor that is an inconvenient rigor. for a world that would like things to be clear, defined, measurable, and all research to be repeatable. Okay, if you're working with living systems, you can't really repeat the research and get the same results. If you did, probably you did something wrong. So again, there was this frustration, coupled with, and I think this is true of my grandfather as well, and it's something that I hold close to my heart, is an affection for life. Mm-hmm. A deep affection for that wonderful process where relationships make relationships, communication makes communication, and living things produce the possibility for life, and vitality is actually life lifing so that more life can life. And that is an incredible, beautiful, sometimes terrible.
Yes.
But nevertheless, it's a source of inquiry and curiosity and beauty and even the sacred, which is unending. It's infinite. So I think their frustration was really based in the habits of a culture that wants to summarize and define and measure and optimize and make efficient and measure productivity and linearize and produce this causality that is decontextualized from the other living processes it should be within. Mm. And if you do that, you come up with really bad questions about what to do next. The wrong questions. Unfortunately, then comes all the interest and enthusiasm to create the projects to fulfill those terrible questions.
Yeah, in a sense, it's expecting the same approach that brought us into trouble is also going to be the one that gets us out of it again, rather than changing a paradigm or shifting or questioning your own questions and how you come about those questions.
It's a big aesthetic shift. It's a logic shift that is quite profound.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about this logic shift from the logic of industrialism and mechanization, as you said, to this ecological, an eco logic.
So recently I had the experience of working with my stepson who was having trouble with some math. And then we gathered some family members around, some of the big brothers and sisters, to help him do that math. In the process, something happened that was really interesting, which was that he started to feel the real linking and the care of his family. And then with that having begun, I went to New York to go do a book launch, and I asked him to help take care of my 95-year-old mother. So I gave him a day to take care of her and paid him for it, and because she doesn't like to have people she doesn't know taking care of her. So then I came back, and in that day, he had to really care for somebody beyond himself. Also he was in relationship with someone who was close to death. And those two things don't seem like they would shape how you study math, do they? Mm-hmm. But they do. And they shaped his whole approach to perceiving how he is in the world, which of course changed the way he was thinking about how he did his math homework and how he was paying attention and what's math for anyway, et cetera.
Right.
So those are a couple of examples of how things move in ecological ways versus what you might see, you know, more readily is something along the lines of, if your kid doesn't do well in math, you punish them. And if they don't do better after you punish them, you fail them, and then they have to repeat it, and they keep getting punished until they learn. Okay, so that's a very different approach,
right,
to open up other contexts of learning and thinking about identity and meaning of life, etc., and let that inform what you might call study habits. And this is something that is definitely not part of your usual school program.
I can talk about it. You can help us a little bit change our approach to teaching, especially, you know, university and me as a educator and in higher education, having some frustrations with the way we go about teaching our students and next generations to follow. And in preparation for that, you brought us something you would like to read us from your new book that may illustrate what we are talking about here.
Okay, so we talked about this this book. So this book combining has lots of different kinds of communication in it. Okay, it has essays, theoretical essays. It has stories. It has poetry. It has imagery. It has different tempos, different rhythms, different flavors. Mm-hmm. It's about things that might touch your professional world, but also it's about sex and child rearing, and it's about all sorts of things. And it's holding all of that because what I wanted to do is to reach the ecology of being that you are, from the ecology of being that I am. So if I have an idea that I want to share with you, I need to share it with you in terms of your intellect, your emotions, your culture, your body, your experience as a child, your experience as an adult, your experience being lost, your experience in cooking with food, whatever it is, there is an ecology of you. And if I am hoping for any shift in the way you see the world, I can't just say, and this is how I want you to change your mind.
Yes.
But what I can do is actually place many things side by side and let you connect them through your experience and have that experience be of an ecological nature. Mm-hmm. So this poem is called Uncut. Every note lands in a teapot of other notes. What are they brewing? Is it an integrity? Those relationships are making more relationships. What have I contributed? How is the ring of my being singing through others? Have I shown up with my many selves? What did I perceive I needed to edit to be in communication with you? What did you need to edit to be in relationship with me? What did I cut? What has been trimmed so that I could fit you into my illusions? What will the wounds say? How will they brew over time? Are we teaching each other to hold back your rage and your wonder, your scratching at life's scabs, and still your soothing fingertips' grace? Both are consequences of time across generations navigating life. Talking about a future, don't stain it with any utopia, terrorizing the necessary complexity. Would it help if I said, we are learning together, shaping each other, unsliced, integrating, reunion, to be uncut with you, uncut in our uncut world.
Beautiful. Thanks for sharing that with us. Just top of my head, the way I react to the poem, just listening in on myself, I feel a sense of liberation, but at the same time also responsibility. Because on the one hand, you know, just thinking about the relationships I'm involved in, friendships and so on, there is a sense of being with somebody. But on the other hand, it also seems that it's unavoidable to cut in some way. And there is this ambivalence of, am I with you or am I making you into somebody who is with me? And there's this mm-hmm. interplay I can hear from the poem.
I think that's absolutely right. And I guess my question is how to recognize that that's always happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
No matter where you are or who you're with. And how are you holding that?
And it also goes back to this notion of care that you brought up earlier, that we do things, but do we do them with care and open eyes, or do we do them carelessly?
And care not just to the first order, but to the nth order.
Can you explain that to us, please? That's a very important point, I think.
Well, we were speaking just a moment ago about how you might try to get a student to do better on their math test, but we could change that. Let's talk about how you yeah. stop poverty, or how you stop climate change, or how you, right? So these global problems or personal problems, they share the situation of being in mm-hmm. ecological process, which means that you can't actually attend to them with direct correctives.
Right.
That would be a first order corrective. So
right.
if you have poverty, you have to add money. But if you just add money to poverty, then all the money goes sweeping up to where mm-hmm. the rich are holding the money. So it doesn't actually do any good to throw money at poverty, because money is only a very small piece of the situation there. And likewise, how we tend to climate change. You know, you could try to pull all the particulate out of the sky, but as long as people feel like they have to prove their identity by having a nice car or wearing a clean shirt
yeah.
or whatever it is that we are doing that requires all the mess of these intersystemic processes of production and distribution and various forms of economic exploitation and destruction, the particulate in the sky is only going to be replaced by more particulate in the sky. So in order to respond to these type of situations that are produced from multiple directional contextual processes, there needs to be uh-huh. a whole different approach. And that approach is not necessarily going to look like addressing the problem head on. So this is an uncomfortable and difficult task, because it's not something that people are used to. And it doesn't look like, I mean, if I were to tell my stepson's teachers that I was going to let him spend a day with my 95-year-old mother so that he would do better on his math test, they probably wouldn't think that that would be a good idea. And there's certainly no statistical evidence to show that it is. And you're never going to get statistical evidence to show that that is, because mm-hmm. it's contextual relational process. So this means that it's going to have to be more than first order. You're going to have to think about what happens after, mm-hmm. and not necessarily in linear causal processes. So this is a way of perceiving that most of us are just not practiced in.
So in a sense, it also speaks against this this tendency, almost knee-jerk reaction we have in, you know, whatever you call it, the so-called Western world, whatever, the modern enlightened world, is to search for quick fixes. So there's a problem, I analyze, understand the problem, and then there's a solution, and then it's done. Not understanding that those solutions probably or very likely will be just bigger, more intense problems further down the line. We just kick it down the bucket.
Exactly.
And what is then your suggestion of how to change our ways of thinking or how to approach problems in a different way?
I think first of all, you have to want to. So it's just interesting because we have been living in a world where we would prefer the security of some sort of certainty, which is totally and utterly inadequate, above an uncertainty that has rigor and depth underneath it and is not eager to cut those relational processes that are producing the situation, but rather to move with them, find possibility within that. So I guess what we're talking about is having people that you can actually do this with and being in a practice where you're not looking for a methodology or a hack or a five-step system or, you know, what is the approach that will get me the ecological response? No, I'm sorry, but you can't have that. That's a collision, a train wreck of epistemologies right there. But you can practice, and that practice is the rigor.
Can you give us a little bit of insight, because you are kind of practicing this yourself in workshops and courses and lectures and so on. Can you give us a little bit of an insight how that looks like when this kind of ecological communication is taking place? I was just about to say when you are communicating ecologically, but that's not true, right? It's not you. It's ecological. It communicates through you and others.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it can look a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Right. So I could talk to you about the Warm Data Lab process if you're interested.
Sure.
But I could also say that this is so much more than any kind of professional endeavor. Mm-hmm. This is much more than, you know, people keep trying to refer to the Warm Data Lab as a social technology. And every time they say that, I feel like there's a fairy somewhere that dies. Like something's not good about that. There's a living wildness that's taking place. I guess for me, what that is possibility. Mm. And possibility in this era when nearly everything seems impossible is a very, very precious thing.
Yeah.
To be nurtured, to be cared for, to be nourished, and certainly not to be obscured or strangled out. So in the Warm Data Lab process, we've made a space where people can, it's a practice place. So we have a question. We have a series of questions that we've tested. And then let's say that question is, what is home in a changing world? Now, home is a complex topic. And if you add in a changing world to it, you have just stopped that question from being a definition process. Home is this, but in a changing world, home is this moving into that, right? And then we give contexts so that groups of people can have conversations and then move between contexts. So what is home in a changing world through the context of history? What is home in the changing world through the context of technology or economy or ecology or family or health or education? And as people move from context to context, they start to, the way that those contexts are shaping each other has room to shift. So I'm not trying to fix the education system or fix the health system or fix the economy or fix people's families, but rather give them a way to perceive and tell stories and weave this tissue of interdependency between contexts in a new way. So this is something that Charles Saunders Peirce called abductive process, and my father worked also with abductive process, shifting that a little bit. And it's kind of, I like to say, it's sort of the unwelcome uncle of systems thinking. It's never really invited to the party because it doesn't allow for causal strategy.
Right.
Where is the change? Is the change in the education system? Is it in the family? Is it in the history? Is it in the culture? Is it in the economy? Where's the change? Mm-hmm. How do you change a culture? How do you change a society? How do we actually live in another way? Well, like my book combining, it's an ecology of communication that has to shift, and it has to shift right from the intimacy of our beings all the way up through the universality of our global situation. And that sounds like an idealistic tall order, but I just have to say it's actually not. It takes about an hour, and the groups of people who are doing this are able to really be doing high level complexity theory without any of the dumb jargon that goes with it. So they're in the complexity. They're not talking about it. And both are useful. Okay. I love good theory as much as the next girl, but when that perception is actually on board and is connected and connecting your own memories and experiences, then it actually permeates your every moment of life.
Going back to the example of the home, that, okay, let's talk about home in the context of health. And then I understand home a little bit. We talk about home in the context of intimacy. And I understand home a little bit better than I understood before. And it doesn't seem to me that's kind of the idea here, that you accumulate knowledge about something, but it's this contextual processes of how context plays a much more important role in all of that. Can you explain a little bit of in that regard of what you mean with contextual processes and how they play an important role in this ecology?
Well, let's stick with our question. So let's say that you and I are sitting in the warm data lab and we've got that question, what's home in a changing world? And we're sitting at the context that's marked health. And we start to think about all sorts of things. Okay, there's really a lot of ways you could enter that context. The health of your family. It could be the health of what your home is made of, and or it's the idea of home as being a healthy concept, or being not having a home, and what does that feel like in terms of health and mental health, right? So already we're looking at lots of different ins and outs of contextual ways of thinking about home in the context of health. And now let's say one of us moves over to, we move over to economy, and we start to think about a home through the context of economy. We've just been over in health. So here we are talking about home and economy, and you might sit down and find someone talking about how everybody in their neighborhood is selling their house because it's an economic boon to do so, or how they have kids that will never be able to buy a house. Or maybe they are thinking about how they live in the house that their grandparents bought a long time ago. What happens is that within about an hour and a half, these contexts start to become clearly intertwined.
Right.
And so you might think that the education system is the education system and the health system is the health system and the technology world is the technology world and family is family. But actually the way in which all of these things are shaping each other is way beyond the grasp of where most people are trying to make change. And so for me, this is really important because, first of all, it's that sense that you had of, oh, this is really freeing because now everything is actually together. And, you know, when you tell a story from your life, any story from your life, how you had breakfast yesterday morning, the first time you went to the dentist. I don't care. It doesn't even have to be an interesting story. Any story from your life is going to hold within it all of these contextual processes from multiple contexts. We live in a transcontextual world. So it's only when we start to study and think we're going to have agency in that world that we somehow decide to break it all apart to do that. And in doing so, there is a very destructive underestimation of these transcontextual processes that leads us back into the same troubles that we think we're trying to address, or new ones that are worse.
Which I guess is an expression of this industrialist thinking, this logic you brought up earlier.
I mean, I'm going to say something confusing here. And that is that most of us have been brought into an ecology of ideas into which the ideas are cut from context. So because that ecology of ideas is a self-perpetuating interdependent process, it's actually perpetuating decontextualizing ideas. So that's a problem, especially when we try to talk about ecology in ways that makes my dad's quote, right? This great quote. We were going to read this quote. This is the moment for sure. He says, the problem of how to transmit our ecological reasoning to those whom we wish to influence in what seems to us to be an ecologically good direction is in itself an ecological problem.
Right.
And so just to illustrate this, I can tell you that in my first book, Small Arcs of Larger Circles, a lot of people did not get it. They couldn't understand why it wasn't a book about systems thinking. And that's because it's a book that is systems thinking. And with combining, I think I've taken that a step further now into just look, here it is. We have to go beyond. I mean, imagine you're talking about how to ride a bicycle. It's not the same thing as riding a bicycle.
Yeah, it's very straightforward when you break it down. Let me take a step back. I guess part of the frustration I'm facing trying to convey this or communicate these messages or this kind of thinking is that it at times ends with, it's a complex world, period. And that's it. So we all give up. We have nothing. It's complex. But what I appreciate about your work is that's your starting point.
Yeah, so that's the thing, is that it's easy to bring the study of ecology into a world habituated with metaphors of mechanistic process. And the next thing you know, we're attempting to do things with ecological process from a mechanistic mindset, and unfortunately is a disaster. That's the same disaster that started and continues.
In a sense, the crises that we're experiencing today is an outcome or a result or a feedback.
It's actually a runaway is what it is.
It's a runaway,
And because it's a runaway, really the only kind of response you can make is going to be one that is going to be those, not one, but many, that are able to hold multiple contextual processes simultaneously. And this, like I said, this is not something that people are practiced in. There's a rigor here that has been absent from the idea of the fix-it and the solutioning and the problematizing and the one-size-fits-alling of whether it's, school tests or psychological diagnostics or economic frameworks or whatever it is, that one size fits all is a non-rigor.
That's true. Yeah. It's the easy way.
And it's just trouble. Yeah. it's an easy way to get into trouble, but unfortunately, it seems to be the most. I think what we haven't said here is the tragedy is that there are people who are prepared to work in this way, but they are not going to be able to put dinner on the table for their children because this is not fundable. So it's coming down to that question of where is the support for this? Where's the working world for all the work that really needs to get done, which is the work of the caregivers and the caretakers and the artists and the people who are taking care of the soil, who are providing that nourishment to life that makes life that makes life. And, you know, you can tell there's something wrong with our social structures when in order to do that, you have to actually step out of those processes that we call productive, right?
It also comes with a little sense of humility that there's just so much you alone can do anyways. So changing that I into a we is, I guess, a starting point at least. So how can we see each other in each other?
Absolutely.
So thank you so much. This was a wonderful conversation. It's really a pleasure to have you on the podcast for all the reasons. It was really very insightful and thought-provoking, especially. And if I can ask you just to conclude our conversation, you know, as I said, the motto of this podcast is that the ecological crisis is foremost a crisis in our ways of thinking or communicating. Just for our audience, so how is the way we think about how we live together today an expression of this crisis? And what would you like our audience to take with them?
Well, I'll read you a poem.
Perfect.
Okay, this piece is called Semathesy, and this is a word that I made up to address this question of how in a family or a meadow or a forest or a city or an organization, all of the entities are learning together, not learning the same thing, but learning together how to be in that ecology. And this is really, I think, for me, addressing the fact that the way that all of us have learned to be in our world includes the ways in which we've been hurt and the ways in which we have had to twist and turn. This is a time when, in order to go forward together, we're going to have to recognize that our learning has made us into crooked trees. So this is called Semathesy. Each one of us is a crooked tree, reaching for water and light, bending ourselves around obstacles, scary thoughts, hurtful moments, darkness, and thirst. Finding a way to breathe in the sun and hold the soil, our branches are kinked and twisted because that's what it took to be here. The ways of learning to be in our worlds have shaped responses. Our mini experiences are speaking through every gesture, our loves, broken paths, a tenderness, a criticism, learning always. Yearning always. In crooked beauty, to be a home for those who may find comfort in the asymmetry of our belonging, a nest cradling new life, tucked into an old log teeming with creatures, learning to be in each other's reshaping.
No, thank you. Beautiful, beautiful words.
You know, there's beauty there. There's weirdness there. There's possibility there. There's all sorts of bizarre, surreal, unthought of, unimagined pathways. And yet we look for the problematique, right? The analysis of how to fix someone. We look for the ways in which it would be nicer if they were in perfect health and harmony, in a perfect utopia, in a perfect world, on a perfect road, on a perfect path. And that is such a loss, because it's in the twisted, rotting weirdness that we actually have the possibility of being in new ways.
That's a beautiful way to come to an end. Thank you so much for being with us, Nora. It was a real pleasure having you.
Thank you for inviting me.
This was the Ecology of Ideas podcast. Production and editing by Emil Monk. My name is Otto Lematon, co-producer and host. Special thanks to the Copenhagen Business School for financing this episode, and to Jakob Barnum, sound engineer at Studio 25 in Copenhagen, where we recorded this episode. Thanks for listening, and we are out.